Now, today, Donald Prothero is here, and it's good timing because they just found irrefutable DNA evidence that Bigfoot exists in Kentucky. They got a picture of him and everything. So why did you even show up, Donald? You're wasting your time. Let me quote from the news story. Bigfoot is real, and now there's both DNA and video evidence to prove it. We've seen the video evidence before, by the way. Claims one group of devoted Sasquatch researchers. The group's never-before-seen footage of an alleged Bigfoot creature sleeping in the woods of Kentucky. Why don't they just go wake him up and say, can we ask you a few questions? Sleeping in the woods in Kentucky has been presented this week along with various blood and hair samples said to be unlike anything seen before. The group's startling statements are supposedly backed by 11 laboratories and universities, which all reviewed the findings. I want to talk to every one of those people. Which all reviewed the findings and were provided with blind samples, according to a report by the Sasquatch Genome Project. I bet they're busy, huh? DNA evidence coming in. Just feel the excitement in the room here about these findings. So, who better to talk about all this stuff than Donald Prothero? He's a former professor of geology at Occidental College, and lecturer in geobiology at Caltech. He teaches physical and historical geology, sedimentary geology, and paleontology. His author co-edited numerous books, including Horns, Tusks, Hooves, and Flippers, The Evolution of Hoofed Animals, Evolution of the Earth, Evolution, What the Fossils Say and Why It Matters, Bringing Fossils to Life, After the Dinosaurs, and of course he has co-authored the book he's going to talk about today, Abominable Science, with Daniel Loxton. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Donald Prothero.
Thanks, Jim. It's good to see you guys on a Sunday morning, bright and early. First time I've spoken to this group. As most of you know, I'm a regular of the Skeptic Society and been a member since they were founded, but I've never had a chance to come over here and join in your activities, and if I get some more time, I'll probably do so more often. But this is something I've been doing recently. This book and the other book I just published came out together the same week at TAM, and so if you were at TAM last summer, you might have seen something of this already, although I've never given this talk at TAM yet. And it's an interesting project. It actually started way back in 2010, and earlier actually, something that Daniel and I had talked about doing. Daniel, some of you know, is the editor of Junior Skeptic magazine, so he writes the back section of every issue of Skeptic four times a year with another story for younger audiences. But he also has spent his whole life as a fan of cryptids. He started out as a believer in cryptids, and then as the more he learned, the more he became a skeptic of cryptids. So now you might call him one of the foremost scholars in the real sense of the word of cryptids. But it was really his project initially, and then I jumped in later in the thought process because I had good connections with publishers, and also because I come at this from a scientific background. I'm a trained paleontologist. I got hooked on dinosaurs at age 4, never grew up, basically. But back when I got hooked on dinosaurs, I was the only kid I ever knew in my whole academic career who got hooked on dinosaurs like that. It was not normal for kids back then. So I came into this from a paleontologist background, but that means I have a strong background in both geology and biology. I double majored in both those. And so I've been in field biology situations. I've studied it formally, as well as, of course, the geologic evidence I'll talk about. So I felt that one of the things that was really missing from this field was the real scientific side of it, because very few real scientists have taken the time to do the kind of work that you'll see we'll talk about here. And so that's one thing I really felt was important. And so we have different perspectives. I come from a skeptical viewpoint as a scientist. Daniel comes from a former believer's perspective as an amateur, but a very well-educated and dedicated amateur. And so we proposed this book to my editor at Columbia, and they were happy to do it. It's been doing very well on Amazon, thank you. And almost caught up with Steve Meyer's garbage book. And the cover design, by the way, was an inspiration of somebody at Columbia, we don't know who, was remembering, this is sort of the standard way that tabloid books on this topic were printed not that long ago. And so this is, if you go out and see the rituals out in the hallway there, that's a big tent cover just to resemble the old-fashioned tabloid-style books. All right, so we got talking about the broad topic was called cryptozoology. The study of these beasts have never been shown to exist by scientists and are puzzling to lots of people. And the first thing that really needs to be brought up, this is a really serious problem with cryptozoology, which is why I come at this scientifically first, is that we have a culture that basically has the wrong idea about science. And I assume most of you don't have that idea, but if you've heard any of these problems, I'm happy to correct them for you. Mostly, especially here at Hollywood, is the chief culprit of this. We present science in a completely false way, as a stereotype, usually the mad scientist, sometimes a mad female scientist is possible. That's getting more common than it used to be. Always with bubbling beakers and retorts and maybe a Van de Graaff generator gets the sparks going. All of it basically is stolen from the classic old Black and White Frankenstein movie. It's the first time you really see that kind of apparatus. And that's a stereotype. Lab coat, all that stuff goes together, usually glasses as well. I don't wear a lab coat ever. Okay? I'm a scientist. Okay? Science isn't about what you wear, it's what you do. Okay? And the problem is, lots of people think they're doing science just by playing with fancy instruments. Right? So you'll see these garbagey shows on basic cable like Ghost Hunter and Monster Quest. And I was actually in an episode of Monster Quest. And what they do for the camera is they'll bring out motion detector cameras, and they'll bring out the night vision goggles and fancy equipment. But the problem with the whole thing is they're not asking the right questions. They're just using fancy toys. So my good friend Sharon Hill over at the iDoubt It website calls this sham science. They're imitating the techniques of science, and the toys of science, but they're not actually doing science. Okay? And she points out, and I've also pointed this out as well, it reminds you of what they're called the cargo cults. For those who don't know this story, a lot of anthropologists like to tell you this story. Cargo cults were a group of these Polynesians who lived in islands that were air bases during the World War II period. And, of course, during the time of World War II, American air bases were a source of great technological advances for them. They got all this equipment and stuff from these planes that flew in nonstop bringing supplies for the war effort. And then when they all pulled out after the war was over, the tribesmen decided they had to bring the airplanes back to bring this bounty of wealth to them. So they made, the airplanes out of wood, and they made control towers out of wood. They even made radar masts out of wood because they didn't understand how it works, right? They thought if you made an imitation of an airplane, you could bring the airplanes back. And that's a cargo cult. They basically don't understand it. They imitate it. It's very similar to what we see with cryptozoologists. So again, hopefully none of this is too basic for all you folks, but let me just quickly go over some ideas that are important in this context. What is science then? It's not the white lab coat, it's not the bubble glassware, it's not any piece of equipment. It's a way of looking at the world, a method of approaching and solving central questions. And the central thing that we always emphasize over and over again, especially when I try to teach this to undergraduates, is that science is about testability. About putting out hypotheses about the world and testing them, and especially if you follow the classic ways of Karl Popper, which are not as widely applied as it used to be, the easiest thing is to prove things wrong rather than prove things right. Because there's not very easy when you make observations of the world to say, okay, well, we'll use an inductive generalization, as they call it. All swans are white. No number of white swans will ever prove that true. But one black swan will prove it false. It's much easier to shoot down ideas than it is to prove them true. Okay, so all scientific hypotheses are essentially never proven true in the strict sense of the word. They're either falsified if they turn out to be wrong, or if you cannot falsify them, then you corroborate them. Fancy word for saying the same thing, but not as saying proving it true. And basically, science in general is not about what the public thinks it's about. It's not about final truth. Scientists don't deal in truth, right? We deal in tentative hypotheses which have been tested over and over again and get more strongly supported all the time we test them. But we always express it in probabilities, right? I mean, you can say it's not a final truth that you're going to jump off a 10-story building, you're going to kill yourself. But I would say your probability is 99.99%. You probably shouldn't do it, okay? Right? We don't deal that way. And as you know, ideologies are the opposite. They have a truth, a dogma, which is central to their belief system, and then they mold the facts and distort the facts and cherry-pick the facts to fit whatever they want to do. And they will never allow their idea to be falsified. Okay, and so that's an important idea. Science is about rejecting ideas, throwing out the stuff we've turned out that doesn't work. And no matter how appealing it is, if we don't have a capability of tossing it out, it's not science. And of course, the great Richard Feynman said this nicely. It doesn't matter how beautiful your theory is. It doesn't matter how smart you are. If it doesn't agree with experiment, it's wrong. Okay? And then something else that the public general doesn't appreciate about science, and I know this more and more as I battle the climate wars and all the rest, science is a very self-critical field of human endeavor. Very little bullshit gets through. Okay, there's some, but not much. Because of the system of peer review, right? Which most people don't understand what that means, okay? Even my students have to be explained to them. We have a system where virtually anything that gets into a scientific journal, at least a good scientific journal, will have it criticized and scrutinized by people who really know a field. And you have to go through a huge gauntlet of criticism and attack to get any idea published. Okay, and I've had my share of getting bruised and beaten, and I get up and do it again. Okay, you can't have a thin skin in science. You have to be, if you want to publish an idea, you have to work really hard at it. Okay, and even if you get it published, it takes science sometimes 4 or 5 years in some cases to really assess what you did. So even if past the first round, maybe 4 years down the line, it's been debunked. Right, that's the way it works, and people don't realize this. Because you, as the creator of an idea, are the worst possible judge of what's right or wrong. Or again, Feynman here. The first principle is you must not fool yourself. And you're the easiest person to fool. Right? We all have emotional connections to our own ideas. And I love this little image I pulled off the web. Science, if you don't make mistakes, you're doing it wrong. If you don't correct those mistakes, you're doing it really wrong. If you can't accept that you're mistaken, you're not doing it at all. Okay. Now, this applies in many ways to cryptozoology. Let me give you an example right off the top here, and then we'll see some other ones later on. One of the biggest problems both Daniel and I face, especially Daniel who did the really detailed library work on some of these older sources, is that cryptozoology is a mountain of bad data piled on bad data. Okay? Which is a very unscientific way of going about that. If you look at the early accounts of what Bigfoot was like before a certain point, or what Loch Ness Monster was in pre-modern times, they're so vague, they're so old, they really don't tell us any more than that somebody had some idea once. You know, they're very, very useless as far as real evidence. And then on top of that, throughout all their literature, high percentage of the so-called sightings and photographs and all the rest are admitted as hoaxes. But they're never taken out by the cryptozoology literature. And so you'll get these compilations of all the sightings of Loch Ness Monster, which if you weed it out, it's got maybe at best a handful that haven't been basically either hoaxed or so vague they don't describe the same thing. Okay? And that's another problem. If you look at these supposed things, they're all describing the same thing. They don't look at all alike when you read them carefully. So they're clearly not looking at the same biological creature, if such a thing even existed. So it's a long list of dubious false claims, and they never clean up the closet. Okay, it's a classic term, the geek closet that keeps falling on top of them all the time. For those old enough to know that reference. All right. Now, again, in pseudoscience, right, we have a problem with the pre-existing belief system, which gets in the way of the data, so the data are twisted, and they assume the supernatural exists, and most of these pseudoscientific endeavors we'll talk about. And they won't, as you said, abandon any notion that they've already come emotionally attached to, no matter what evidence shows up. And as Sharon Hill pointed this out as well, the difference is really striking. Scientists, or at least the scientists doing their job right, when they find something unexplained, they don't immediately jump to a supernatural explanation. They just say, we don't know. Okay? We haven't figured it out. We're going to look at it further. They don't say, oh, automatically makes it Bigfoot. Okay, but that's the way a pseudoscientist operates. And then we, of course, must abandon ideas if they have now been weeded out and shown to be false. Okay? And so some of these elements that we're going to see when we talk about how a pseudoscience like cryptozoology operates versus real science, the subjective, personal experience is not much value at all in real science. Okay? Most things in science have to be reproducible, observable by more than one person. And I'll show you why that's really important in a moment here. Scientists have to bend over backwards, eliminate their own biases. You don't set up your experiment to prove what you want to believe, right? You try to disprove it, and you don't assume that if you find something out that's unexplainable, it just means you haven't explained it yet, okay? And then a good scientific experiment of the kind that we'll talk about here, how do you know it's just some random noise, sound, sights, right? Those are controls. If you really want to do something, like Ben Radford said, you go back to the original spot and see where it really looks like, and put something out there to judge how big it really is, which he's done for things like some of the lake monsters, which they never do. They just take the count and they run with it. Okay? Plausibility. How strong is your evidence in the face of all the facts that are against it? Right? It has to be very strong. And then finally, can it pass the scrutiny of peer review? They'll say later, these things, if they had good evidence, would be published in scientific literature. When scientific literature is happy to publish outrageous stuff, but it has to be supported by good evidence. So what we're dealing with then is what Carl Sagan called baloney detection, or Ken Pentola called bullshit detection, whichever you prefer. And the famous statement made by a number of people, this is Carl Sagan's version of it, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, right? There's so much evidence against these things being real that you can't just show another piece of footage that doesn't show something. You have to have something really extraordinary to overcome that. The burden of proof is now on the cryptozoologist, right? Just like, you know, in 1859, the burden of proof was on Charles Darwin to show that evolution had occurred. And the evidence became so overwhelming within a few decades that by the early part of this last century, already the burden of proof was on people who wanted to doubt evolution. Although you don't get that in American culture very much. And then special pleading, ad hoc hypothesis. You can't worm out of something if your data showed to be false. So, for example, the fact we'd never find any physical remains of Bigfoot. Oh, he's an alien. He leaves no bones. Well, that may make you happy, but it's not science, okay? And I love this little quote, famous one from Thomas Henry Huxley. The great tragedy of science, the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis. Okay, fact. Okay? And I pointed this out in my current blog post, for those who read my blog every Wednesday at skepticblog.org. One of the common things you commonly find in this is that they play a lot of the same games that creationists play and other science deniers play, because if you're going to be a science denier, there's always a standard way of attacking science. One of them is credential mongering. Show up someone who's supposedly in your field, who supposedly has a proper degree. So they'll point more often than not to a guy named Roy Mackle, still alive, born in 1925, so he's really old now. He was, in his early career in the 60s, a reputable geneticist here in Chicago. Then he got tenure, so it didn't matter what he did after that. Okay. And in 1965, after he spent, you know, a good part of his early career publishing on fruit fly genetics and that kind of stuff, he went to Loch Ness and apparently had a conversion experience. We all know what those are like. And the entire rest of his career, he threw aside his legitimate science and spent his whole time chasing monsters. Loch Ness Monster and Mokelumne Mbembe are the two which he is most famous for. But just because he knows a little biology and he can analyze genetics of fruit flies doesn't make him a field biologist qualified to chase large vertebrates. Okay, he's not a field ecologist. His training is irrelevant as far as he never once had any field experience. Okay, but the cryptozoologist will point to him and say, Rory Mackle, PhD, as if he's a super expert in every topic. Well, those of us in this room who have PhDs know really well what it means. It means that you were able to focus on one extremely narrow topic for about 5 to 6 years and to jump through all the various hoops the university's put in your way and get that magic piece of paper, okay? It actually decreases your depth, your breadth as a scholar because you spend all your time on one narrow topic. And so the only place in which your PhD is relevant is if you're studying a field that is actually what you're trained to do. So I'm a PhD, but I don't use that to fix a car. And it doesn't qualify me to write a symphony. And likewise, people like Roy Mackle not qualified to do field biology. His PhD is not in that field. Or Dwayne Gish or Henry Morris, creationists who wave their PhDs around. Their fields are completely outside of paleontology, yet they both talk about fossils if they knew something. Okay, so what we need to do is have a sort of ranking of what kind of evidence scientists would take seriously if they ever show up with this type of evidence for these creatures that have not yet shown to exist. And the only really good evidence, as far as I'm concerned, is something physical. Okay, it's got to be real, something people can actually test, something that they can look at, they can pass it around, a critical scientist can look at. Ideally, a live animal, if not that, a carcass, if not that, bones, teeth, something tangible. Okay, not one of these has come out yet, despite these reports of Bigfoot hair, which I'll talk about in a second here. You could say, well, maybe a really outstanding video or really outstanding photos. Or recordings of sounds. Well, no, actually, I don't think that's going to convince many people. We have so many examples of hoaxes of these, both in still photos and movie photos. And even if they are not hoaxes, it's often difficult to tell what they really are. They could be bears. They could be guys in ghillie suits practicing their camouflage hunting. Yeah, there's lots of possibility to decide you're a mystery monster. Okay? I don't even consider this evidence. Footprints, scratch marks, they are legendary for being hoaxed. In fact, you can actually buy Bigfoot shoes online and make your own footprints if you really want to do it. But they were done for decades. And then the least useful evidence of all, which is the primary evidence that all these people believe in, is what the eyewitnesses say. Okay, when you say, whoa, eyewitness testimony, don't we use that in court of law? If you've read the work of a lot of people lately, her name escapes me though, but the famous psychologist who worked on this, the more they looked at human perception and human recall, the more it's clear that eyewitness testimony is just about garbage. Okay? People do not see like video cameras. People see with a selective view and a selective memory, so many things can get you so you don't actually see what was really there, or distracted from it so you see something else and don't really see what you saw. And then often the case, your memory will then supply details, especially if it's suggested by your culture, that weren't actually there. I'm going to show you a video. I assume most of you have seen this before, but some have not. It really sort of opens people's eyes the first time you see it. Let's see if we can get this to run first. There's a famous little short clip done by a lab. Richard Saunders has shown this at TAM a few times, but for its short, so I'll run it for you guys. This is the famous selective attention test. Don't say anything. Just follow the instructions. Okay, you're supposed to count how many times the player is wearing the white jerseys and clothes pass the basketball. So yeah, some of you have seen this before, but not everybody has. Okay, so follow the white players. Count how many times they pass the basketball. I'm doing my own count here, but I'll let you do yours. It's very hard to do, you see, because they're distracting as they move around so much, and then you know, keeping track of everything. Okay, we're almost done with the counting here. Hang on. Okay, how many counts? Call it out.
14.
15, 14. 15 is the correct answer. Now, watch this. Now, you guys probably seen it before. You knew what to look for. But many of you who've never seen this before don't realize that while you're focused on them counting those basketball shots, that gorilla walks right to the shot. At least some people in this room didn't giggle when he popped that mark in the shot. Okay, so that is a classic example of this. So that's called inattentional blindness. It's a specific kind of poor memory, but there are many others that have been researched over the years, so it doesn't matter which one it is. The point is, everybody is capable of this. We are all terrible at recording the actual environment, okay? And in particular, because eyewitness accounts are what we call anecdotal evidence, they're easily convincing to, if you talk to your back fence neighbor or friend, right, I don't like this product, you know, I do like that product, or this teacher in my school is good, this one's bad, that's okay. That's not scientific evidence. That's not the kind of evidence anyone else can really evaluate very well without a lot more data. And, of course, you all know that works very well in our advertising world. You get an actor to pretend to be a doctor or just a celebrity to get up on camera and give testimony about a product, people will buy it, right? Just like he's a backfence neighbor. Okay. Anecdotes don't make science. This is from Frank Soloway. 10 anecdotes are no better than 100 anecdotes are no better than 10. They don't add up. Okay, they're all equally bad. It's like adding up zeros doesn't make any more than zero. Show you some famous cases of this. This was one in 2004. Hunter Dennis Plunknett in Arkansas was shooting away, looking out for wild hogs and shooting for them. Yeah, someone hollered out, hog. He swung around. He saw something moving. Fired. It was his son. Okay, and he was wearing a survival cap, sort of like this. That's how close he looked like a hog. Okay. Doesn't matter. When you're a hunter, and this happens every year in hunting season, they fire away without really checking who they're looking at, and they kill a lot of people. Okay, you've all read Michael Shermer's Why People Believe Weird Things. There's that famous story early in the book where he describes being captured by aliens and going onto their ship, and then describes, of course, it was when he was under a storm of stress from 40, 60 hours of bicycling across the country and was hallucinating. Okay, people do this very easily and don't realize they've done it. Okay, or some of you remember the DC sniper panic in 2002, or for weeks there was all this noise in the media about they were looking for a white box van with a roof rack and some two white guys shooting away. And finally, when they caught the snipers, you remember the snipers, John Allen Muhammad and Lee Malvo, two black guys in a blue car. Okay, Okay, there they are right there at the bottom. In fact, the policeman actually said, the chief, we were looking for a white van with white people, and we ended up with a black, blue car with black people. Every one of the eyewitnesses is wrong. They actually had these guys in the roadblock several times, but because they had the wrong search image, they got the wrong people. Okay? So this is what all these psychologists now show. We are easily altering our memories and easily misremember things by enhancing them or putting in things our culture suggests. A lot of research has shown, for example, that people think they are UFO abducted. There's basically a hallucination caused by stress or sleep loss. There's actually various kinds of sleep mechanisms that cause that. Okay? And also, you've got to be careful about talking about anything that someone who's coming from a non-Western culture would say. Okay? Your tribes people of Africa or your tribes people of North America. Right? Their concept of what we call real and non-real is maybe quite different from what we do. Right? They may not distinguish between dreams and reality, between legends and mythology and reality as we do, okay? Nobody in the cryptozoology committee is out looking for Thunderbirds, but Native Americans believed in them just as much as some of these African tribesmen believe in Mokele Mbembe. There's no difference as far as I'm concerned, okay? And then when you go to these people, you know, people in Africa especially, when they do this with Mokele Mbembe, you can't show them a picture of a dinosaur and get them to say, oh, that's it, that's leading the witness. In the court of law, you're not allowed to do that, right? You're planting suggestions, and they're more likely not going to agree with you just to make you happy. In fact, I discovered this, especially with the Yeti stories. It was very common in Tibetan culture and Nepalese culture to tell the white guy whatever he wants to hear because they want to keep you happy, your guest, okay? All right, so back to what cryptozoology is. What is it? Okay, the name literally means hidden life. Cryptos is hidden, zoos is life, okay? And the term cryptid was coined by these people to basically describe a creature not previously described to science, known largely from folk legend or indirect evidence. In other words, no scientific evidence yet. Well, if that's the case, there are lots of small animals that have been described by science recently that weren't known. And just a few months ago, you know, there was a report of a new species of a raccoon relative down in South America, but it looked very similar to others. They'd actually had it in collections for a long time and didn't realize it was a different species until they looked again. Okay? So we're finding monkeys and deer and lots of small mammals all the time. But nobody considers those startling or unusual, right? They're just part of known zoology. So that's not cryptozoology as most people mean the term. Cryptids, as most of these people mean it, are truly singular, unexpected, paradoxical, striking, upsetting. This is Bernard Hoyvelmans, who actually coined the term cryptozoology, saying this. So that's what we're really talking about. And then they point again and again and again. Yes, I love that image. To various animals that were not known to science and known only in legend. And say, oh, well, these things were not found by science. Therefore, you know, well, science did find them eventually. And the mountain gorilla and the okapi both live in deep parts of the jungles of the Congo. So it's not surprising it took a while for Westerners to find them. But remember, that was over 100 years ago. Okay, that's not recent. Okay, the more recent ones, the Kubri in 1937, the Komodo dragon in 1912, the Chaco and Pepe in 62, most of them, especially these two, are animals that only specialists can tell from another. I actually work on peccaries, so I know how to tell them apart. Okay, so most of these things that they say, oh, well, the scientists didn't know these until legends have been shown, they're 100-year-old examples. And recent science hasn't found anything large or startling or worth making excited about. And they always point to the coelacanth, just like creationists have their favorite things they pound on. They say, oh, the coelacanth was a mystery. It's said to be extinct for 50 million years. No, actually, 5 million years are off by order of magnitude. Found in South African waters in 1937, then the Comoros in 1952, and then eventually we rediscovered it in South Africa, and then there's a separate population now found in Indonesia. And the point being that, well, yes, but the deep oceans are a different game entirely from the shallow waters on land or from land itself. There are much more things down the deep ocean, especially if they're not air-breathing, that we are finding all the time, giant vampire squids and that thing. That's a different game entirely. It has no relevance to talking about Bigfoot. Okay. Because what happens is that the scientific community has shown this, and there's a whole field of ecology about this, is that you can actually predict how many species of a given group is left based on their discovery rate, okay? It's a curve. Basically, looks like this. It's a curve of diminishing returns, where early in the exploration of a particular group, this is seals and walruses and sea lions in this case, you find lots of new species, and as time goes on, there's a plateau, and you don't get any new species because most of them have been found already, okay? And what's happening is that this has happened to just about every group of mammals you name. If you get one new species a decade, you're lucky. They're probably less, okay? But the more and more we look around the world, the fewer unexplored regions there are. And the fewer large animal species are to be found, especially large mammals. So it's getting to be the interesting paradox. The more we look, the less we find. Okay, and now there's 7 billion humans on this planet. There are not many places where human eyes aren't all the time. Okay, it's not like it was a century ago when the early cryptozoologists would go to the unexplored jungles of Africa. There are no unexplored jungles of Africa anymore. Everything is human at this point. Okay, so our chances that a large crypt exists are getting worse with time. And as reports come in, they're even worse quality than the ones before, and there are fewer of them. That actually makes their probability even lower. Okay, so there's our discovery saturation curve for seals. And what it does, it predicts, if these things apply, and Daniel and I put a couple of these in the book as well, if they apply to cryptids, it means that what they are, they simply cannot be found now. Okay. Now, the biggest thing we noticed, and we did mention this over and over, is that what you see a pattern when these things are reported. They're reported in such a way that it doesn't make any sense biologically, but it does make a lot of sense culturally, okay? In other words, what you find is that cryptids are highly influenced by whatever cultural event is in a particular culture at the time, especially TV specials or something in the newspaper. And then once that becomes viral, and it did come viral with board computers, by the way, then it was copycatted. And so you'll see this explosion of reports right after the first one, and then it will tail off until it gets back to background. And then a new report, and it will go down. That's all culture. That's not biology, okay? It's not a pattern that a real creature would show. A real creature would consistently be seen over a long period of time and not, you know, showing up only after the media talk about it, okay? Again, a good example, I'll mention this again later. The first plesiosaur-like Nessie accounts, the ones that are from so famous from Spicer, came out the same month that King Kong was aired in Scotland. Okay, King Kong, I'll show you in a moment, has a Nessie-like creature in it. Okay, explosion of stories in the media, then it died down. And I'll talk about this one example. Chupacabra didn't exist anywhere until a woman who saw the movie Species with Natasha Henstridge, and she barely didn't realize it was fiction. Okay, and so then it got picked up by tabloids, Puerto Rico, and then Christina Perilegui, the Oprah of the Latin American world, put on her show, and suddenly Chupacabra is in every country in Latin America. Magic. And back to my point earlier, you know, people say, oh, well, what about the unexplored jungles of the world? Well, the deep ocean may be that way, but nothing much on land is inaccessible or hard to find anymore. Both Daniel and I spent a lot of time in the Pacific Northwest, the so-called Heart of Bigfoot country. Daniel actually was a shepherd when he was a young man, working in clear cuts like this for years at a time. And so he said he saw lots of stumps that turned out to be, or Bigfoot that turned out to be stumps, bears that turned out to be big, or Bigfoot that turned out to be bears, and that kind of stuff. And even a century ago, this was wild and explored country, and even many other parts of the world were. Now we have 7 billion people on this planet. There aren't many wild regions left, especially not with much larger animals, okay? Their habitat shrunk so much they don't get sustained anymore. And if you haven't been to the Pacific Northwest recently, when you drive around, it's a real shock, okay? Because what they do is called clear-cut logging. You can see it's better from the air than the ground. But they literally strip an area bare except for stumps and broken limbs. And they often leave just a screen of trees by the highway so you don't notice it, okay? That's how logging is done. And there isn't much of that habitat, wild habitat, left in the Pacific Northwest that isn't clear-cut. If it's clear-cut, then it's regrown, and you're looking at not an old-growth forest, but a second or third growth. Now, the other thing that makes the world less mysterious and also much more accessible than it was just 100 years ago, you can go to Google Earth right now on your laptop and see any place on the planet at high resolution, right? You know, there's hardly any place that can escape scrutiny. I mean, well, you can watch your own backyard on Google Earth right now if you can type in your address, right? Satellite image is so good now, in some cases with really good ones, you literally can read newspaper from space, but at least a meter to resolution. So anything like a large dinosaur-like creature in the Congo or a Loch Ness monster, you know, well, enough people watch Google Earth every minute that someone would see it. Okay, and this is an image I pulled right off Google Earth, and the coordinates are in the book. Okay, I caught a still image of elephants in space. Okay, and the animal we're talking about in Africa is bigger than an elephant, yet it's never been seen. And so this little cartoon came out on the web just a few weeks ago, and it's really very powerful evidence here. This is the percentage of the U.S. population carrying cameras everywhere they go, every waking moment of their lives, most of us have something like this in our pocket now. Right? It's no longer the case you have to be lucky and carry a camera at the right time. And then the rest of the captain says, in the last few years, with very little fanfare, we've conclusively settled the questions of flying saucers, lake monsters, ghosts, and Bigfoot. Okay? The more cameras we have, the fewer good images we get. Not the better images. Now, someone told me they actually heard that the Steven Spielberg himself no longer believes in extraterrestrials just because of this. Which, of course, is strange because he's the one who made extraterrestrials more popular than any single human on the planet. All right. So, as a biologist first, and this is where my primary training is, I've been giving you some biology now. There's just some more. We're not talking about a single creature in any of these cases, right? To be around for more than a few years, it has to be a population. All right, there have to be daddy, mommy, and baby Bigfoots, okay? Not just one Bigfoot, okay? And a breeding population has to have a huge egg range. And so the longer you have these not actually documented, the less likely to occur, because there's supposed to be more than just one, all right? And what we know from field ecology and theoretical ecology, we can plot the amount of home range that an animal needs for a given body size, okay? Very straightforward mathematical relationship, and there's the formula for those who are math inclined, okay? So a thing as big as Bigfoot or McKellen, but maybe would have a huge hundreds of square mile range per population to actually survive. And yet the ranges are shrinking. The number of acres of old growth forest and places where humans aren't is virtually nil now. Okay? And so the same goes for the lakes that supposedly harbor things like the Loch Ness Monster. They're not big enough to support a population of animals this big. Oops. And another interesting thing, especially in contact with the people who think about Loch Ness monsters as some kind of a plesiosaur, a long-necked reptile from the Mesozoic, you go to Loch Ness today, the water is just barely above freezing, even in the summertime, and it does freeze over in the winter, okay? And you can actually look at the distribution of reptiles today, okay? And, for example, this is crocodilians, you know, crocodiles, alligators, their relatives, they're also almost all tropical, virtually none of them outside the tropics, but even lizards and snakes virtually all live in the subtropics or tropics, and very few, and none at all, live in the cold climates, okay? Right outside of Loch Ness are there two species of lizard and two species of snake. They spend most of your hibernating because the resources are so poor and the weather's too cold. Cold-blooded animals can't live in that kind of climate. And the same is true. Lake Champlain, Lake George, Lake Okanagan are all in cold climates under snow half the year. Not a good place for reptiles. As a geologist, this is the one that I always consider the one that clinchers. People forget, although geologists have known this for well over 100 years now, the entire northern half of the northern hemisphere was covered by a mile thick or more sheet of ice only 10,000 years ago, okay, peaking at 20,000 years ago. And this happened 24 separate times in the last 2.5 million years, okay? There's no place for a Loch Ness monster to hide, okay? It can't live in an ice cube, and it doesn't apparently live in the ocean as far as you can tell. So all those lakes with lake monsters were in ice. There's no place for the monster to go, and all of them are landlocked. There's no place for the land monster to get from the ocean, okay, including Loch Ness, which can get it has an uphill struggle, about 50 feet uphill and a very steep gradient to get anything in there that's a certain size. So again, here's the extent of the ice sheet across North America, and Lake George, Lake Champlain, Okanagan, all the rest of the lakes in North America supposedly have lake monsters. Well, they were all under ice only 10,000 years ago. Forget it. Okay, to me, that's case closed. Right? Why even waste your time thinking about something living in those waters that could not live in ice cubes? Okay, as a paleontologist, this is something I wanted to really contribute to this effort. People just underestimate us. You know, they don't realize how much we know now. Maybe 50 years ago we didn't know a lot of this, but we do know it now. The fossil record, we won't pretend it's perfect. But for large animals, it's extremely good. The larger the bones you have, the less likely they are to be destroyed. The more likely they are to be preserved. And so there's a very well-known relationship. We get an excellent mathematical modeling of how many species of large animals, like rhinos and things I work on here in North America, once lived. Because they very seldom get missed, okay? And especially when talking about Ice Age animals, and I published papers out of Rancho La Brea down the street here, Ice Age animals, you know, in Rancho La Brea alone, we have tens of thousands of fossils from every species in the dark pits. Okay? And most of them, at least. And then across the collections of Ice Age mammals all over North America, hundreds of thousands of some of these things. Okay? The sample size is enormous. And even the relatively rare animals, like the North American cheetah and the goat-like camel, we still have dozens of their fossils. Okay? Not a single primate for the last 34 million years in North America, other than humans, of course, right? Nothing.
Not even a lemur-like primate, but certainly no Bigfoot fossils. It's not for lack of trying. Everything we can find, we have found. Okay? So you have an excellent fossil record also of large marine vertebrates, both dinosaurs and plesiosaurs. Not once they show up after 65 million years. Okay? And we have marine beds like Sharptooth Hill up in Bakersfield, where we have whales, we have sharks, we have lots of other large marine vertebrates. They're all mammals or fish, but no plesiosaurs. So it's not for lack of places to find them. Okay? And likewise for Africa, its fossil record of land animals is excellent. It's been well studied. There's a huge new volume on it. Just came out a couple of years ago. Not one dinosaur shows up any continent, Africa included. All right. So those are the broad perspective things. Let me now get to the nitty-gritty of a few of these creatures. And these are, by the way, Daniel's original paintings, most of these, from the book. That's part of the reason we did the book the way we did, and it's a glossy paper and weighs so much. Because it's supposed to have good quality reproduction and beautiful art, which it does. All right, America's favorite cryptid is certainly Bigfoot, for sure. It's always in the news. It's always on Discovery Channel, History Channel, or Hysterical Channel, whatever you want to call it. It's not history anymore, that's for sure. And I'll just lay it down right here on the front. There's no evidence, period. No physical evidence. Not a single bone, not nothing, okay? And not what it is, what you heard claimed. The Bigfoot DNA that you just heard in the media, okay, if you go to my blogs on skepticblog.org, and also Sharon Hill did this, and some others did this as well, that study by Melba Ketchum, which was finally released last spring, as soon as an independent lab got a chance to look at her samples, they found she had no idea what she was doing. Okay, she was completely incompetent to run DNA analysis. And she had lots and lots of mismatches, lots of bad steps. And when they reanalyzed everything the right way, all they got was lots of human hair, okay? And a few of the wild animals, including the unknown that made Melba Ketchum supposedly freak out, which was a possum. She didn't put a possum in the sample. And so that's all it is. That's the cutting edge DNA research. And yet it just got in the media last week, even though it's been completely debunked in the scientific literature. And the way she published it, if you guys follow the story, she couldn't get it published in a major scientific journal because as soon as a real scientist looked at her work, they saw it was garbage. So she bought her own journal online and published one paper in it, hers, and charged you $30 per copy to download it. So she's actually using it as a scam to raise money. Okay? That's the best science they have. Okay? I wait to see anything better. All right? And, of course, even if we had, say, Bigfoot DNA from a piece of hair, well, how would we know it? We don't know what Bigfoot DNA is supposed to look like. All right? All we have is, say, unknown DNA, and that's the way Hirsch said he is. It's unknown, therefore Bigfoot. No, it's unknown, therefore unknown. Okay? Until you know for sure what Bigfoot's DNA looks like, you can't make any statement to the contrary. Okay? And so then you'll get these special pleading, these ad hoc ways of saying, why do we have no bones for something that lives in every state of the Union except Hawaii? Okay? Why do their bones never show up? Oh, well, they decay faster than the bones. No, that's actually false, because large bones don't decay faster. Small ones do. We never find bear bones. Actually, Bigfooters themselves report finding bear skeletons. I found bear bones. Daniel has found bear bones. They're not that rare, okay? They just don't know what they're doing, okay? Bear bones are found all over the regions where Bigfoot. In fact, there's an interesting study, which I link in the book. They have exactly the same geographic distribution as Bigfoot, and their density of population apparently is the same as well, which tells you something. And you might remember back in 2008, this is in the media all over the place. The Georgia Bigfoot hoax, right? There's a Bigfoot in a freezer in Georgia. Two Georgia patrolmen reported it. And then finally, all the Bigfoot believers jumped onto it, proclaimed they had it finally. Finally, someone examined it. It's a Bigfoot costume in a freezer. Okay. That's all it was. And of course, it just died in the media. But the problem we have here is that the media now has this giant need to be fed. 24-hour news cycle, 7 days a week. Got to have new stuff to catch readers' eyeballs. Okay, so there's no filter anymore. There's no screening. There's no quality control compartment like the news that Walter Cronkite had in front of him to check it before it goes on to the internet, before it goes on to these media. That's part of the problem, is there is no filter anymore. All the garbage goes just as fast as real news. The most famous case of this, and I had a violent debate with the guy I debated in this bookstore up the street here about a month ago, is the famous Patterson-Gimlin film, the only film that supposedly shows Bigfoot moving, okay, other than this new one, which looks like me like a rug. And it's got a sort of divided history. The believers say, oh, it cannot be anything but a Bigfoot. Others say, yes, it's a guy in a suit, and not even a good suit, okay? It's certainly not an ape, okay? You watch it on that footage, and you can play it on YouTube as many times as you like. It's walking like no ape that's ever lived, especially not things like an orangutan or a gorilla. Its legs are too long. They're human proportions, completely bipedal. It's human gait with maybe a funny hitch or two, but it's human in every respect, okay? But more importantly, even if you say, okay, we can't decide one another, is it a hoax or not, then follow the money, just like, you know, they did in All the President's Men, right? Tracking that Watergate. When the case is inconclusive directly, you go to the source. Who stands to gain? Who reported it? Well, Bob Patterson and Gimlin both are known pranksters and hustlers. Patterson was legendary for being basically a scam artist. His whole life, he borrowed money and stole money and never repaid anybody, never made an honest living once, and late in his life, he knew he was dying, he knew he had to provide for his family, and so he and Gimlin got out there with their movie camera, and the very first day they go out in 1967, they get the footage. Okay, very convenient. All right, and then he gets the rights to that footage, of course, and Gimlin does too. That's been their gravy train ever since. They have no reason to ever challenge it. Well, Daniel did some research, and the first report of a Bigfoot that looks sort of like the report from the Patterson Gimlin film, William Rowe, back in British Columbia in 1955, about 12 years earlier, reported to a newspaper. No one ever followed up, and none of those guys back then ever interviewed him, even though he was the first to report it. You read the report that William Rowe reported in British Columbia, it's like it was a script for the actor in this costume. He does exactly the same motions in exactly the same way. Which is very, very suspicious, right? That you happen to catch the first footage of Bigfoot and he's following the script that Rowe wrote 15 years earlier, okay? Well, the man in the costume, Bob Hieronymus, has already confessed, although some doubt him. The costume maker who modified the arms to make them longer has confessed, okay? Again, Bigfooters don't believe these confessions, okay? And then anything else I've seen since then is the same story. It's really either, it equally has, this is the one that has the best credibility and is terrible, okay? Trackways. This is the most common thing you hear about Bigfoot. Well, the trackways all started with a famous prankster named Ray Wallace, who was around these construction sites up in Northern California, up in the Klamath Mountains, up by Bluff Creek. And his descendants have, there's Ray there, his descendants have his Bigfoot shoes. They found it in his belongings when he passed away. Okay, he was known to have been pranking the people doing the construction. He'd go out at night with his Bigfoot shoes and make tracks all around the heavy equipment. Every trackway since then turns out to be either a hoax or it doesn't prove anything. And the bigger problem we have, especially with more modern footage of Bigfoots, the joke is they're all blob swatches. But how do you decide where this dark shadow is actually something? You know, well, that could be, you know, a Bigfoot in a tree, but there's a mama bear there that could also be a baby bear. That could be a lot of things, all right? I mean, how there's anybody decided that little dark shape in the back was something, or this is not a human just walking down the side of a river? You know, that's a quality of evidence we're talking about. And so this is what they call the blob splotch scale, a complete blur of something looks like the Patterson-Gimlin film. And then the joke here is your blob splotch has got to be somewhere between the Patterson-Gimlin film and a blur. And if you can't enhance it, then you draw a red circle around it to make sure people can see it. So here's Bigfoot trying to get on Facebook. Every one of my pictures is so freaking blurry. Bigfoot is blurry. That's the problem. So, you know, I would say, even though this one's the most popular of all the cryptids, the story is really pretty much, as far as I'm concerned, case closed. Okay, he's now more than 80 in this headline here. The forests are vanishing. There's not enough land to support a population supposedly as big as this, okay? There are fewer reports rather than more, okay? The reports used to be more common and even fewer quality photographs than they used to be. And I think the most important thing of all is the people who never report Bigfoot are wildlife biologists. Who actually know what animals are supposed to do and actually know what sounds are made by different animals. Quality of scientific education, and when they are in the wild, they don't ever see Bigfoot. It's just amateurs who don't know one animal from another. That, to me, is a very, very revealing thing. And then this cartoon, no longer made, sadly, but a very interesting one. They're telling the king, report from the Bigfoot research team. We totally found him and stuff, but like all our cameras stopped working. Same time, dude. Weird, huh? So we're going to need a bunch more funding. And then he asks them, aren't you the guys from the UFO research team? Now, this one's also a big part of our culture, even though it's not North American. The the so-called Yeti, the abominable snowman. By the way, the title was our publisher's idea. I said, oh, that's going to drive away all the people who want to, you know, think we're fair. Well, that's the title anyway, the abominable snowman. All sorts of images that you see from the classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, from Monsters Incorporated, and here we go, Bigfoot is a lounge singer, snow, 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 dance, or Yeti kill you, Yeti here all week. Now, the name is usually Yeti, which is from Nepalese, the animal rocky places, or sometimes Mete, or man-bear. The fur trade, the bottle snowman, doesn't come from the people who know this creature, supposedly. It was actually a tabloid journalist named Henry Newman, working at a British newspaper in Calcutta, who got the reports of the Meto Kungmai, the filthy wild man of the snow, from Tibetan couriers who came back from a British expedition. And he decided that wasn't colorful enough, so like all tabloid newspaper reporters, he changed the phrasing a bit, as in faked it, and abominable snowman became a legend. And then suddenly that made it a creature that everybody cared about, just by changing the language. It has lots of local names, and nearly all of them either suggest it's a mythical beast, or it's the Himalayan bear, okay? And you think, oh, how could he be mistaken for a bear? Well, of course, in the zoo, it doesn't look much like that, but actually they rise up and walk on their hind feet a lot. They're the same size, the same color. In a dark or forested area of the Himalayas, you can easily mistake something like this for another. Every sighting, as I just went through in detail in my chapter on Yeti, they turn out to be hoaxes. Langur monkeys, other types of animals, most often the Himalayan brown bear, and one in particular was a rock outcrop. The guy was wondering why the Yeti was freezing so long. He had to leave, came back a year later, and then got close enough and found it was a rock. Okay? And then whenever these so-called Yeti expeditions go in there, and they try to find the den of the Yeti that their guides tell them is here, they find an angry mama bear coming out of hibernation. Okay. But more commonly, what is Yeti is hoaxes. Okay. Every bit of Yeti hair, Yeti hands, Yeti scalps that they have in various Nepalese monasteries, when you actually get a sample of them, they're bears, they're goats, snow leopards, a whole bunch of animals that actually live in the Himalayas. Most of the Yeti photos and all the video footage have turned out to be hoaxes. This is the most famous one. This was on a Fox TV special some years ago, and then finally when they got the pressure on them, they realized this was all a hoax, it was all staged, it wasn't even in Nepal. They confessed to hoaxing it, and then shamelessly, a year later, they showed on a show called Most Famous Hoaxes. And then again, same story of footprints. Now, footprints in the snow are a big difference from footprints in the mud. Every one of these Yeti footprints turn out to be, this is the famous Shipton print, for example, they're very easily explained as bears, which walk in their own trackways as they go. Most four-footed animals do. Their hind feet fall right about roughly where the forefoot was, and they'll leave an enlarged track, which will have toe marks. Okay, Himalayan brown bears make it, and if you melt it a little bit, it'll look even more human. Okay, plus, anyone who shows you a plaster cast of a print in the snow is lying to you, because if any of you ever made a plaster jacket for your broken arm, it's an exothermic reaction when plaster sets, isn't it? It's hot. It's quite hot if it's a large enough amount of plaster. It melts the snow faster than it sets. But nonetheless, the Yeti people, some of the Bigfoot people, all say, oh, well, there is Gigantopithecus, which was a real ape fossil-like creature from the Ice Ages, mostly in China and more lately in Vietnam. It's only known from the lower jaws, parts of a skull, a lot of isolated teeth, and it is huge. But almost everything we know of it, and that's not much, of course, says it's very orangutan-like. Would not have been anything like the so-called human-like Yeti or Bigfoot. Certainly didn't walk like one. Here it is for scale there with my son in the foreground. It was big, of course, with only heads, with only jaws and teeth. You can't really tell how big it is, but think orangutan, not Bigfoot. So here you got your selection of things that could be Yeti, including the Himalayan brown bear and human hermit and the Tibetan blue bear and Gigantopithecus supposedly still alive, or maybe he's just one of these other things, okay? And there's a famous quote in Reinhold Messner's book about this topic. He's one of the most famous recent mountain climbers. He actually climbed Himalayas, especially Mount Everest, by himself without bottle oxygen twice. And he's been on every other peak in the Himalayas, and he spent much of his career going to peak, climbing every peak in the Himalayas. And he also did a lot of time talking to people about Yetis and interviewing people. And at the end of the book, he talks to the Dalai Lama, and he says to the Dalai Lama, is it really a Yeti, or is it just the brown bear and everyone in Nepal's, the secret? And Dalai Lama smiled and said, yes. The Nepalese know better. But it's good tourist trail. And I was in Kathmandu, Yeti stuff is everywhere. So just like if you go to Scotland, Nessie merchandise is everywhere. It's a good tourist trade. And of course, this is even in Scooby-Doo now. It's everywhere, right? It's just this British equivalent of what we have for Bigfoot. Well, here's some reality check on that. There's Loch Ness. It's a fault valley. That's why it's so straight. It's been scoured by glaciers, which were there only 10,000 years ago, so it's why it's so deep in that particular area. Okay, but it's not a very big lake by the standards of these lake monsters, certainly not by the standards of the animals supposed to live there. And it's actually a very starved lake. It has almost no resources, very little in the way of fish population, or any food to support a monster, let alone a population of them. Okay? And as I said, the only way to the sea is up a very steep set of inclines. It's about 50, 60 feet above sea level. A monster would have to come out of the ocean and never live again in the ocean and get up there against all that. And the only thing that's ever managed that came from the ocean was some seals. But this thing is supposedly much larger than that to get there after the ice vanished 10,000 years ago. Now, what's really revealing, as I mentioned at the beginning about Loch Ness Monster, is that it had a bunch of legends, you know, from the Romans and St. Columba and all the rest, none of which describe anything like the modern version. And then its modern incarnation came in weeks after King Kong was aired in Scotland. And then, if you ever watched the original classic King Kong with Harryhausen stop motion, okay, they have a Duplessis-like creature that King Kong attacks and kills, okay, which to that point had never been animated before. It's no surprise. It was a big cultural influence, okay? And the man who did it was George Spicer. He was the first to report it, and we know he saw King Kong a few weeks earlier. So, again, no signs, no King Kong comes out, and then all of a sudden there's an iconic version of the Loch Ness Monster that everyone latches onto. Please, these are alike, okay? And then, as I said, the sightings come and go with the latest news report, okay? Then the news reports die off, so do the amount of sightings, okay? Plus, huge amounts of time and money have been spent. I mean, gigantic efforts. Sonar over and over again over every square inch of that lake, okay? Giant scans where they have multiple ships combing the lake like lawnmowers from one end to the other. There's nothing could have gotten through that, okay? Lots and lots of imagery at the bottom, lots of dredging. Not one piece of anything has ever shown up. No reasonable sightings, no bones, nothing moving in the water that couldn't be explained by a large fish or something like that, okay? So what you have is mostly famous hoaxes, okay? Nearly all of the history of this thing is famous hoaxes. This is probably the iconic version of the Loch Ness Monster you've seen probably 1,000 times. But if you actually see it without all the cropping, here's how big it really is. These are ripples. It's not giant waves. This thing is floating in ripples on a little pond. And this was in the news. First, it's called the Surgeon's Photo in 1934. It was in the news for decades. It was accepted as real for decades. When the guy passed away, it was turned out it was a hoax. The guy had used a toy submarine and created a little fake neck on top of his toy submarine and then photographed it. Okay? The spray photo from the same time is basically the same story. Very blurry, hard to tell what it is. This is the famous Stewart photo when it was finally revealed what these bumps are. It turns out they're floating bales of hay covered by tarps roped together. It was a deliberate hoax. This is the famous McNabb photo, and everybody, including the cryptozoologists, agree that it was doctored. It was not a true image. This is before Photoshop now. Anyone could doctor a photograph. Okay? You've probably seen this one on lots of the Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster specials. It's called Flipper. Well, here's the actual image. It's just a cloud of bubbles, okay? And all you can do is crank up the contrast, get a little photo enhancement in there. Ah, well, the bubbles turned into a flipper. That's exactly what's done there. It's very, you don't see a flipper clearly in this image at all. This famous one they call the Loch Ness Muppet, so obviously just a hoax. But the previous image was actually given a scientific name by Peter Scott. He called it Nessiterix rhombaterix. The Ness Wonder with a diamond fin, but if you shuffle the letters, it also spells Monster Hoax by Sir Peter S. So a lot of these people know exactly what they're doing. And of course, the people who make a living off of the monster hype of tourists out there are happy to keep it going. Okay, well, Kelly Mavembe, this one you may remember, was in this terrible movie with William Catt and Sean Young a few years back. And of course, it's been in lots of other things. Hollywood has revived it several times. There's a Scooby-Doo about it as well. This is supposedly where it lives in the upper reach of the Congo, in Congo and Gabon, and a couple areas like that. Very small area, actually, that it's supposed to be from. And if you read it carefully, this is the chapter also one of the chapters I wrote. All the accounts of it from the last century that it was reported are highly conflicting. And they don't all describe the same thing. Some actually describe a more stegosaur-like creature than the kind you see in the previous slide, or even a triceratops-like creature. In other words, it's not the same thing. Many of these things actually appear to describe rhinos, and you don't realize until you learn something about African biology. Rhinos don't live in the jungle. You know, that's different from what you learn from Diego in your childhood. Rhinos don't live in the jungle. They live in the savannah. These people in the jungle have never seen a rhino before. So they could easily be talking about that as well. The really strange aspect of this creature, it's aquatic and it barely has no need for air. It can submerge indefinitely. You know, they seem to go underwater and then no one ever sees them. But if you've ever been in those rivers, and I've been to Africa, those rivers are not that deep in most places. It's a big animal like that can't hide that long. And the bigger problem with it is almost every account you read of these things comes from missionaries. It turns out missionaries are the number one reporters of this monster, and creationists, as I'll talk about in a moment. They're trying to please you, right? It's very common in cultures if you ask someone questions, they will tell you what you want to hear. And then they don't distinguish probably between what they consider legend and what you would consider legend, right? The legends are real to them. Plus, they show images of these people like they did in the Monster Quest on the Caliban Mapi I was involved in. These two guys turned out to be creationist ministers, not biologists, and it was obvious how incompetent they were when you watched the footage of them. They show these guys pictures of dinosaurs, leading the witness, okay? Not allowed. And then all the photographs, I'm going to go over this at length, they're all clearly either fakes or they're so blurry you can't tell what they are, or they turn out to be kind of hippos or people in a canoe. You know, there's simply nothing really concrete there. So going back to the points I made earlier about the scientific evidence here, right? The fossil record of Africa is excellent, especially for large mammals in the last 65 million years since dinosaurs have been extinct. Not one dinosaur fossil anywhere. We have excellent dinosaur fossils in Africa, older than this, but not after 65 million. Okay? Plus, this is a very big animal. It's a large population would be required. The bigger it is, and the bigger the population it would have had, the larger area it would have to occupy. But again, these jungles are not unexplored anymore. Not only do they have native populations, but wildlife biologists are going through them all the time. They don't find anything. It's just amateurs and a few creationists that find stuff, okay? And again, if you're looking at Google Earth, go ahead and watch all you like. They're probably visible from space if they're real. Now, what Daniel and I discovered was interesting, that the entire Mokele Mbembe myth, just like King Kong originated Loch Ness, Mokele Mbembe originated right around 1910 or so, at the very time when the very first sauropod dinosaur skeletons were mounted in museums like the American Museum where I was trained in New York, the Yale Peabody Museum had the first two up, and then they had illustrations, this famous old Charles O'Neill illustration. It became a cultural icon, and then bang, suddenly it's found in Africa. Interesting connection there, okay? And what's even more revealing is that what they talk about when you read, say, Mackel's book on Mokele Mbembe, they're talking about the version of sauropods that we thought over a century ago, okay? But what's happened the last 50 years of paleontology is that that version has been thrown out the door because it has no bearing on reality. Sauropods don't drag their tails. They don't live in swamps. They actually lived in high, sort of marshy areas and even drier areas. All these things that were thought about sauropods 100 years ago are wrong. So this kind of creature never existed. But this is what they're trying to match, something that actually turned out to be false. And yet they never changed their stories because they don't keep up with real science. Okay, I'll briefly talk about chupacabra. That's come in a lot lately. The name literally means the goat sucker in Spanish. Ben Radford did a whole book on this, so this is largely derived from his work. Supposedly sucks the blood of animals, though. When you look at the sucking marks, they turn out to be fang marks, the canine marks of animals that kill by crushing the throat. And the blood's gone, not because they sucked it out, it's because the animals died and the blood's at the bottom of the body. They don't know the basis of biology there. But the first report by this woman, Madeline Tolentino, in Puerto Rico in 1995, came out right after she saw the movie Species, which was partially filmed in Puerto Rico. They used the Arecibo Space Telescope in Puerto Rico as part of the location. It's not unusual. I mean, people here in Hollywood who can't tell fiction from fact when they watch movies, let alone in other parts of the world that don't have the education that we take for granted. So she, you know, it's not surprising. She might have thought the whole movie was real, okay? Then she supposedly saw this creature outside her door killing her chickens. And the tabloids picked this up, and all over Puerto Rico for a while, and the tabloids and sightings suddenly everywhere. As soon as you publicize it, sightings start happening. And then, as I said, not found in any other part of Latin America until the year later when the Christina show, the Oprah of Latin America, had an episode about it, and then every country in Latin America had reports. Okay, very cultural. What's really revealing about it, this is the monster from the movie Species called Sil, And this is Man on the Tunnel Dino's original description of it as other people have rendered it. Now, it's very clear where the influences lie. So, and as Ben Radford showed, he interviewed Tolentino, he could really tell. She believed the movie was real because she thought it was filmed nearby, and therefore the space telescope was a clear thing. There was the laboratory where the experiments must be real too. Okay? And then it said the pattern is a cultural spread, right? First Puerto Rico, then Christina reports it all over Latin America. Not very much outside of Latin America, by the way. It's a Latin American equivalent of Bigfoot. Every culture has their own, apparently. Okay? And then now, the Latin influence out here in the Southwest, especially Texas, anything that they don't know what it is becomes chupacabra, right? Usually an animal without hair, with mange. They don't know an animal without hair. Okay, I'll show you what I mean. These are all dead canines, either coyotes or feral dogs, and yet they probably had mange before they died, and people cannot recognize an animal without fur. I don't know what the wrong problem is. I mean, I'm a paleontologist. All I have to do is look at the teeth and I know what it is, okay, or the bones. But everybody else has to have hair or it's something, some supernatural creature. So this is what most of the Texas chupacabras are. They're dogs or coyotes that have lost their hair, therefore they're supernatural. Or you'll see a raccoon without hair or an otter without hair on the internet. And again, with loss of hair, animals look very strange to people. I don't know why, but they do. Okay, so here we have our little cartoon. This is the original chupacabra, and there's our Texas version right here. And the guy's saying, oh shit, look at this. Diseased coyote. No, it must be a chupacabra. Okay, so let me wrap this up then. We had some interesting commentary I noticed on our website for CFI just before I arrived here. I won't say who was commenting on it. Saying, oh, this is junior skeptic stuff. Okay? No, actually, this is really important because you as skeptics, the most common topic we get out there outside of religion is UFOs and Bigfoot. And so if you want to be a good skeptic, you have to be armed with all the evidence because, yes, Bigfoot is big in this country. You may not realize that 20-30% of Americans, probably a lot more than confess, believe in both Bigfoots and UFOs. Okay? And in terms of paranormal beliefs, most of the culture believes at least one paranormal idea. The paranormal is normal in this culture, as most of us in this room know. Okay? And you think about this, it actually makes a lot of sense from what we know about psychology and about past human cultures. Until very recently, all human cultures all over the world have always had monster myths. Right? They've always had some mysterious, unexplained feature creature, whether it's a monster or it's part of the mythologies or religion. That's the norm for humans forever. Okay? We are probably the only and first time ever major culture that did not believe in monsters, officially at least, you know. Think about that. It's very contrary to our human nature to be a skeptic, first of all, and not believe in monsters is even more rare, okay? Everybody believes in monsters all through time, okay? Reason and scientific thinking, critical thinking is a very hard uphill struggle, as all of us in this room know, and very hard to convince people who love to believe in the mysterious. It makes them feel good. Okay, and what I found was when some of our stuff came out, if you go to the Amazon site for our book, we've got three or four nasty, really below-the-belt attacks on our book, and they all come from people who are true believers in either Bigfoot or Nessie. And what they'll do is they'll nitpick at little details, one chapter, and they completely miss it. In fact, they confess they never read any of the rest of the book, and that's still because it's a one-star review. I talk about being very objective and scholarly there. And this is a big thing because really what this, my last skeptic blog post just went up last Wednesday, says it's really like creationism. It's a central belief system for them. It's essential to their well-being to believe in Bigfoot or believe in Nessie. If you criticize it or attack it, they get very upset. Okay? It's very serious to them. Okay? And as I said, a general, even though not all Americans are hardcore, at least 30-20% of Americans believe in Bigfoots and UFOs, no matter how many times it's debunked. Of course, as often as they appear on Hysterical Network and Discovery Channel and all the rest, it's getting harder. This little quote here says a lot of it here. Across human societies, variations of mythical creature stories like a Bigfoot have persisted for thousands of years. Accounts of seeing and hearing them still abound. There may be a basic culture-based need for these fantastic tales. This is what Todd just tells in New York State. Monsters represent dark aspects of our subconscious worlds. Being metaphors or challenges of life, this is a psychotherapist. Some monsters are scary, some monsters are friendly. Sometimes in movies or myths, we befriend the monster, and it's just like our inner world. There are monsters, there are dark age aspects we have to face. That's really, really how the human mind works. But the human mind is very much like X-Files, I want to believe, right? The truth is still out there. They will not accept what we tell them, okay? And so here's some classic diagrams of acceptance of Bigfoot. And they definitely probably range at least 30-35%. More males than females, but not by much. And same in Canada and the U.S., only slightly different numbers, okay? It's almost a majority viewpoint in many parts of the U.S., okay? And what you find, and this is what my last chapter of the book is all focused on, is why do these people believe this? We did a lot of digging into what was written and what was said about the cryptozoology subculture. It's a subculture like, you know, Star Trek fans, right? Or a subculture like the Star Wars fans, right? The people who go to Dragon Con, right? They have their own world unto themselves. You guys in this room are a subculture of a different kind, okay? They are their own subculture. They have their own jargon. They have their own organizations. They have their own procedures and standard myths. You know, they talk in a lingo. They say the PG film. They're not talking about its MPAA rating. They're talking about Patterson Gimlin, okay? And everyone in that culture knows that abbreviation, right? The shoot, no shoot controversy. Believe it or not, that's controversy in the Bigfoot community, whether if you find a Bigfoot, you're supposed to shoot or not. Okay? That's what they worry about. Okay? Reminds me of certain scholars and clerics in the medieval times who argued how many angels dance on the head of a pin, but that's another story. Anyway, the Bigfooters are really basically hunting for Bigfoot. It puts them in the nature, gives them something to do. Instead of hunting for a deer, you hunt for Bigfoot without a gun. Okay? Or you're a bird watcher, right? Get you out of nature. Test your manhood against the, and this is mostly men in this case, test your manhood against the wild, right? Therefore, you have an excuse to go out and thrash around the bushes and do stuff. You're a Bigfoot hunter, okay? And tremendous amount of anger and resentment by these amateurs against us professional scientists because, of course, they don't like what we tell them, right? Science has told them again and again, you can't ape scientific culture, you have to do it, okay? But they don't understand enough of it to actually know what they're doing, okay? Oh, this is a long quote here, but it's worth reading because we have the time. This is a, I'll read it for those who can't read it in the back. This is a quote from an article written by, where's his name, down here at the bottom, Mike Leggett, who was a reporter for the Texas paper Austin American Statesman, and he went to the Bigfoot Research Conference in Texas, and his report said this, Bigfoot is boring. Correction. Bigfoot conferences are boring. Okay? Bigfoot would not be boring if the conference speakers weren't so dull. Heck, most of them barely breathing. I went to the 2009 Texas Bigfoot Conference expecting people in gorilla suits milling around in semi-crazed gangs of gonzo, tattooed, barrel-chested bean dips. I found instead a polite older crowd of mildly sleepy true believers who only came alive at the mention of the TV show Monster Quest or the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek. Now surely someone would be selling Bigfoot BLTs, Bigfoot lettuce tomato sandwiches, abominable snowman cones during their lunch break with their only Cokes and Subway sandwiches. Trying not to sound breathlessly moronic and relentlessly off-kilter must be hard work. A stream of people calling themselves Bigfoot researchers droned on all day, talking about satellite imagery, global rainfall patterns, Bigfoot territorial behaviors, and specialty fieldwork searching for Bigfoot signs. Even the crowd of believers was getting died out by afternoon. I was asleep and drooling down the front of my shirt. The discussion was arcane, jargon-laden, focused off on something they call cryptozoology, based on the study of animals not yet proven to exist. And I guess that's what the conference is all about. Attempts to prove that Bigfoot, or Sasquatch if you prefer, does live in some place other than legend. Actually, what they're trying to do is get mainstream science to admit that all the misshapen plaster casts and bad photographs and overdramatic TV shows are evidence that the creature lives in Texas and other states. That's reporters' sarcastic account, but I love it. So again, it's about believing in the paranormal. Our culture in general believes in the paranormal, much more so than doesn't believe it, right? And what's interesting, Daniel pointed this out a number of times in our interviews since the book came out, you'll say, okay, well, the cryptologists say, well, Bigfoot's real, but not UFOs. Okay, we're not, you know, crazies, right? We want to be taken seriously as zoologists and scientists, so Bigfoot is plausible because it's biological and UFOs aren't plausible. Yet, first of all, if you look at the studies like the Big Baylor Religious Survey, mostly it's an overlapping population. Those who believe in Bigfoot also believe in UFOs. Very high percentage, okay? And then you say, okay, you're a believer in Bigfoot, okay, and here's the lines of evidence you have. It's all eyewitness accounts. No physical evidence. It's eyewitness accounts over and over and over again. That's its basic plausibility. Well, there are actually more eyewitness accounts for UFOs. Why don't you believe in UFOs if there are more eyewitness accounts? There are actually more eyewitness accounts for ghosts, but you don't believe in those? Or how about fairies? They're all based on the same quality and same quantity of evidence. And yet somehow Bigfoot's real, UFOs are not, ghosts are not. Okay? Right? And this is all eyewitness evidence. And that's basically what entirely supported by it. Not one of these has physical evidence. And yet the Bigfooters reject all the rest of these, but Bigfoot's eyewitness evidence is somehow different, which is pretty bizarre if you think about it. Okay. So could they be scientific? Could they actually pass this muster of science, okay? Like they do it now, clearly they don't, okay? They absolutely refuse to reject their ideas. They refuse to test their ideas. They must have their Bigfoot. It's part of their belief. So this is what Sharon Hill said. This is what I said in the last chapter. If you want to be taken seriously about science, instead of beating us up for being skeptics, okay? First of all, the first thing is, if it's unexplained, it is not necessarily paranormal. It's just unexplained. Okay, don't jump to the conclusion the paranormal is real because you haven't explained something. You've got to get high quality data. Bring me a body, then I'll take you seriously. No more eyewitnesses, that's no good. No more fuzzy photographs or bad videos, no good. Okay, don't waste your time until you have that. Okay, I know scientists who've actually gotten sucked into this. My good friend Cindy Anderson, who was one of the first reputable mammalogists to watch the Bigfoot film from Patterson-Gimlin. He made an effort. He opened a spot in his schedule. They brought the film in. They showed it to him. He politely said thank you and let them go. And then never did anything more about it because he knew it was a full-out fraud. And he looked at it. He's a good mammalogist. And he spent the rest of his career dealing with Bigfooters who imposed on his time to help them with their Bigfoot expeditions because they thought he was a Bigfoot believer. Okay? That's why scientists don't want to waste their time doing this. It's a waste of your time. Don't repeat the debunked stories that are weeding out the bad apples. They keep piling up bad data, double bad data. Doesn't do any good. And if you really want to be taken seriously, you better face the gauntlet that I face. Go publish in a real journal, not in something you own or something that you created out of thin air online just to get it published, quote unquote. All right? And firstly, you've got to go through the peer review. You've got to be open to criticism. All scientists have to get used to having that happen to them with thick skins. And if you have a thin skin, you don't belong in science. Okay. Now, they say, oh, well, it's harmless. It's Judeo-skeptic-like material. And we're not worried about it. It doesn't really change our culture much. Daniel sort of believes that, too. But I'm different. I've got 40 years of the scars of my hide from dealing with creationists. Creationists are a big threat in this culture. And there's a big connection here. Cryptozoology, first of all, is very sloppy, very anti-scientific, non-rational, illogical. I look at it as a gateway drug. You start with this, every other sort of scientist goes right along with it. And many of these guys, that's what they do. They start with Bigfoot, then they go into UFOs and so on. Okay, that to me is just a sign you just don't take it lightly. But the worst aspect of all, it's very interlocked now with creationism. All the people who search for McKinley Bemembe are creationist ministers. Not biologists, creationist ministers. Especially William Gibbon, who's shown here in the lower left. He was the guy in the Monster Quest that I was in. And I didn't know when I filmed the episode who else was in it. I was filmed in Occidental for like half a day, and 3 minutes remained in my footage when I was finished. And I was there just to be the token skeptic of what was mostly a pro McKinley Bemembe show. And then I saw the episode finally, and said Gibbon and his partner there. I didn't know who they were, but I could see they were not biologists because they simply had no clue what they were doing. They didn't even know how to use their equipment properly. And they made all these ridiculous assumptions. And of course, they were leading the witnesses by showing pictures of dinosaurs, these tribesmen. Okay, well, I find out later that's what they are. They're creationists. Okay, they somehow think that if we find a McKinley Bemembe or we find Loch Ness Monster, all of evolution will tumble down. Not the gigantic amount of evidence apparently that we have. They don't seem to know about it, of course. This is actually recent. To disprove evolution, Louisiana educators are at least being told to teach the Loch Ness Monster is real. Okay, that's a gateway to creationism in Louisiana education, which already has a gateway since they changed the law there and allowed creationism in. So I see that as a very serious issue. Okay, maybe not some people, but I do. So let the buyer beware. Caveat emptor. Always. If it seems too good to be true, you probably know that. You probably ain't. So here's our two cryptid friends, cryptid pals, believing in each other. All right, thank you. Bigfoot believers who are offended at this moment. I had a bunch when I did that bookstore up the street. They were really pissed at me. Okay, a question way back there. I can't see any faces, so I can only see your hand.
About the connection between creationists and apocalyptics. Because creation would imply 6,000 years.
Oh, I know. Their consistency is not what creationists are doing. They believe dinosaurs live with humans, right? That's part of most creationist viewpoint, the Ken Ham worldview now. And so their idea is that somehow if they can show dinosaurs are still alive with humans today, then somehow all of evolution will be undermined, except, of course, that's 95% of the evolution's evidence unlike that, and they don't care about that evidence, but that's the way they think. You know, it's all or nothing, black or white. One dinosaur disproves evolution just like one coelacanth does, or one Loch Ness monster. All the Nessie hunters, by the way, are creationists now as well. So that's where it comes from. It's coming from creationists largely at this point. And I don't want to get in a long diatribe about creationism. I've fought it too long. Question over there.
What about the money?
Yeah, show me the money trail?
Yeah.
Well, the most obvious one is that anybody who produces any of this stuff for public consumption can pretty much guarantee it'll be bankable. So you produce, like Patterson and Gimlin did a legendary film, you own that rights. Patterson and Gimlin, and Patterson's heirs, I should say, had all that money from that film, and every time they licensed it, they never had to pay, work a day in their life. So Patterson found the ultimate scam, right? Something he would pay his descendants when he died, which he did shortly after the film came out, well, the rest of their lives. But the other money source is, if you ever go to Kathmandu, you go to Lake George, you go to the cities up and down the coast of Loch Ness, you go to Lake Champlain, you go to Lake Okanogan, it's a huge commercial market to have your own monster. Okay? You're in one of these lakes that has a legendary monster. You literally have a festival for it every year during the tourist season. You have merchandise at the wazoo in every place. You can buy it anywhere along the lake shore or whatever. That's a giant income source. And you think any of these people have any best interest in something? You have the right idea. Okay, question over there.
Has any of these people trying for a Templeton funding?
Well, the only ones that are overtly religious about it are the creationists. The rest of the Bigfooters, generally speaking, not necessarily very religious. They have the Baylor survey showed that they have about extremely conventional viewpoints in almost everything, including the percentage of religious and percentage in different kinds of religious groups. They're very, surprisingly, not as wacky as you think they are. They're very normal people with one wacky idea that they spend all their time on. Just a peculiar hobby, and all of us have peculiar hobbies one way or another. So, but unfortunately, it's a peculiar hobby with interesting consequences. Okay.
You should call your book Spoiler Alert. But you could go into the comedy scene. You know, you could do all these laugh stuff places.
Well, I'd be happy. You got a connection. Let me know. I've done a bunch of podcasts. I've done a bunch of radio interviews. So has Daniel. And we've tried to get onto bigger media. So far, we've only reached smaller audiences. But, we always figured Bigfoot might actually catch somebody who's big in this part of town. Has a bigger media reach than we do. So if you guys know someone, pass the word. We'll talk to their bookers right away. So, over there. Go ahead.
How can you know that no Neanderthals exist somewhere in Siberia or the Himalayas?
Okay, good question. In science, remember, that we don't have a final truth, right? There's no absolutes, right? And so that's a typical question anybody who believes in these things say, oh, well, you can't prove a negative, or it's not absolutely certain that these things don't exist. No, but science doesn't deal in certainties, okay? Science deals in probabilities, right? And as an example I used at the beginning, said, I don't know for sure if you jump off a 10-story building, you're not going to die, okay? Although I think your probability would be in the 99% range, okay? But there have been people who hit the pavement and survived, right? There have been instances where somebody got lucky and someone happened to get a net under them or a soft object under them and they bounced. Okay, so there are ways it could be surviving unlikely. But as I said, if I were the person jumping off the building, I would think those odds are against me. And likewise, all this biological evidence, and especially the fossil record. The Neanderthals have a good fossil record in Europe. And they don't exist in Asia from the fossil record at all. They're strictly Western European. And the Neanderthal bones are easy to recognize. I've worked on anthropology my life to know the difference between that and Homo sapiens. And there's no evidence there's any younger than 30,000. Okay? Lots and lots of Homo sapiens in lots of places. And they're very well sampled too, right? The fossil record in humans is amazing, especially over the last 20,000 years. Okay? But we're talking about a gigantic absence of evidence that should easily be found. That's why I don't think it's real. Okay, another question. down there in front of him.
This is a little off topic, but have you ever studied cattle mutilations?
Yeah, to get off topic, you're right. No, cattle mutilations, I'm sure there's a literature on it. I haven't spent much time looking at it. The common thing is that animals die in the wild all sorts of ways. And there are lots of predators who do things you don't realize they can do. Maybe not cattle mutilations, but animal mutilations that were turned to chupacabra. They say, oh, he sucked the blood out of the animal. Well, when you actually look at the bite marks on the animal, it's always two bite marks to the throat or four, which is what most large predators like dogs do with their canine teeth, which they use to crush the windpipe and strangle animals. That's how large carnivores kill, cats and dogs both. Okay? And then sometimes they bleed out from a neck wound, but most often they don't because those aren't large wounds. So the dead body then lying on the ground for 24 hours, the blood all pools to the bottom. So people come to this animal and they look at the top of the animal and it appears the blood isn't there anymore. It's on the bottom of the carcass. Okay, and they go, oh, it drank all the blood. No, bloodsuckers don't create two little puncture marks. That's Hollywood vampires that do that. Okay, a bloodsucker, you look at a vampire bat, okay, it has a set of its razor-like teeth and slight cuts a slice. That bleeds much better than two little holes. Okay, and then they lick it all up. All other blood-sucking animals, and Ben Radford pointed this out in his book, have a specialized proboscis like a mosquito has, which is a hypodermic syringe, right? It punctures your skin, sucks blood directly. Okay, that's not the canine teeth of a dog. Canine teeth of a dog have no holes in them. They're not suction, they're just their punctures. So that's the big problem. And then what happens is people don't realize, well, it was killed, and then they sucked the blood, and they didn't eat the animal. No, lots of times dogs and wild predators kill many more animals than they will eat. Especially when they're in a frenzy and there's a big attack going on. And so they won't kill all and eat all the animals that are there. They'll leave a lot. That doesn't make them supernatural, just that's normal predator behavior. Okay? So I think a lot of your wild cattle things, it may be a different case of this, but large predators do this kind of stuff. They can maim the cattle and do a lot of stuff to them that people don't recognize, and that doesn't prove that supernatural forces happen here. Okay? Another question? Okay, back to there by the wall.
I spent about three summers out of camp in Lake George around 1960, and I remember we heard about local legends, especially in the woods, but
yeah.
I never heard, we sailed and canoed all the time, and I never heard anything about a lake monster.
Yeah, the Lake George monster, I think, is relatively recent. I forgot the year that it was first reported. You can look at Ben Radford's book on the lake monsters, and he did every one of them, including Nessie. And the thing about this particular book, we intended to have that chapter on all this, and so I wrote about the lake monsters of Lake George, Lake Champlain, Lake Canoga, and all the rest. And then when the book went to the publisher, it was twice the original contracted length that we were supposed to write. And so the publisher said, we got to cut stuff out. So my chapter on Chupacabra and my chapter on lake monsters got cut out. And so it isn't as many animals as I wanted to put in, because I did all the research and writing and actually got the art permissions and everything. However, if it sells well enough, they'll have to do a second edition, and then maybe I can convince them to make it longer, because the length it is now didn't seem to sway the sales. So I'm happy to see that. Another question. Everyone wants to run to lunch now, I guess, right? Oh, here we have one more.
When I was thinking of this whole thing of the term, don't confuse me with facts, my mind's made up.
Yep. The True Believer, right? Eric Hoffer described this many, many years ago. Have you ever read his book, The True Believer? It's all, whether it's a Marxist, whether it's a creationist, they have a certain set point of viewpoint. It's part of their internal anatomy in a lot of ways. You know, it's essential to their well-being, essential to the way they look at the world. And once you are that locked into that kind of viewpoint, nothing will change them. That's why our battles with creationism are largely sort of rear guard actions. We're doing our best to prevent the spread of creationism, but we're not making any real dent on their overall numbers by direct attack. Because people who are creationists will never change that way. It's the people who are on the edge that I reach the best. So my 2007 evolution book, the thing I found was most revealing was, the creationists themselves never saw the book existed, which is typical. They don't look at any book they don't want to read. But what I found, if you look at the Amazon reviews of that book, there's almost 100 of them now, it reached a lot of people who were on the fence, who didn't know what to think. They'd been raised in a church and sort of told a little bit of creationism and maybe a little bit of exposure to evolution in high school or college, and they were confused. And that 2007 book, I thought, was its best effect was it made it crystal clear where the facts lie, and it was confrontational. I would try to make it that way. They called them liars when they were liars. But it nonetheless, it reached a lot of people. And that was what I thought was very effective. Now I thought when we first were writing it, we would say, okay, Daniel especially, because he was a believer to start with, said, okay, we're going to try to be very careful, very thorough, very non-judgmental, as much as we can. You know, go through all the evidence very carefully and examine it, but not necessarily dismiss it. And that's why the chapters were so long. We went over length, because we were very thorough and did a lot of research, Daniel especially. And what I really found was important was that that establishes our credibility, not just to people who agree with us, but even the cryptozoologists. The few positive reviews of cryptozoologists have said that they agree we really did our homework. That's crucial, because we have really done the work a lot of them don't even bother to do. And then their problem is that we had piled up such a mountain of careful research to counter what we've done, they'd have to do even more, which I don't expect to happen. So we'll see. I mean, we're getting two responses from the community. A couple of them have been fairly honest and fair. And then we get the type of stuff you get on Amazon.com with the one star. Go read those if you want. They're bizarre. These guys rant about nitpicky detail in Daniel's part of the Bigfoot chapter or the Nessie chapter, okay? And then Daniel's actually answered them on skeptic blogs. You can go back to old skeptic blogs, see Daniel's answers to them. Because it shows they don't know their homework as well as Daniel does. But what it really says, and this is what I posted the last week, so go to skepticblog.org or look at my last post. These guys focus on the trees and don't see the forest, right? They never read my first chapter, which has all the scientific evidence and makes everything they're believing implausible, and never even gave the book a fair shake. They just focused on their favorite animal, one chapter, nitpick details, and they don't realize the entire book has to be debunked before they can be taken seriously. And they're not going to do that, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. Any others? Yeah, go ahead.
Has anybody done any MRIs on the people who have these?
Well, not MRIs, just regular verbal surveys and surveys on tests. Now, that's the problem is what those surveys already show is that most believers of this stuff and UFOs and all the rest are just like you and me. Okay, they're conventional lifestyles, conventional percentage of people married, divorced, conventional number of children. They don't stick out in any demographic thing you can name. Okay. And that's what's really, so some people think, oh, it's only the crackpot young men who want to go out there and hunt Bigfoot. They're going to be Bigfoot. No, but the vast majority of Bigfoot believers are everyday people. In fact, they're majority women, just like the population is general. Okay? And there's maybe a little bit more belief in Bigfoot among men than women in some parts of the country. But overall, they're unremarkable. They're everyday. And so what you're really asking is, how do our brains work so that we are atypical skeptics, right? Because we're the freaks, okay? We're the ones who don't think like most humans have ever thought before, right? We're the ones who don't believe in mythology without evidence. And we are the minority. You all know that, okay? Very, very few people walking that street out there think like you and I. And I'm sure you've had your experiences with that in your time, okay?
Let's do one more question.
Okay, one more, right there.
Well, I'm sorry, I just want to follow up on what you were saying here.
Sure.
So there's also no correlation between formal education.
No correlation. Well, as in a sense, there aren't many PhDs who believe in this, but, the degree of high school or college, general college education, unless you've had a college education focused on the biology relevant to these things, your college education is no more relevant than anything else, right? And yes, that's true. Their demographics education-wise are more or less the same, too. Most of the PhDs, like yours truly, don't spend any time on it at all. I just did this because it was a book project. I normally would not be obsessed with these issues because I have a career. I have research on my own. I work on fossil mammals in North America. I work on a bunch of stuff. I have a family. My time is valuable. So I only did this because this is a book project. It's not something I would have spent time on otherwise.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.